It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Vickers.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Later in the hour, we'll hear your thoughts on a continuing trend in Wisconsin. People are leaving rural areas, leaving the state, or headed over to bigger metropolitan areas.
First, a new study measures how much we believe in health-related conspiracy theories and how those beliefs might affect our behavior in the doctor's office.
Thomas Wood joins us now. He's co-author of that study from the University of Chicago Political Science Department. It was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association Internal Medicine. Tom, welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Well, first of all, what kind of medical conspiracy theories are we talking about?
We're talking about theories which, on their face, shouldn't elicit much support among those whose primary source of medical information is medical professionals. So quite extreme, quite broadly implausible accounts wherein the United States government and the FDA and pharmaceutical companies know about yet suppress safe natural cures for illnesses, and yet for a profit motivation, I agree not to make those drugs available to the public. Or the idea that vaccines are able to cause autism among young people. Stories which are very anomalous and aberrant to the types of things that we know cause health and sickness from the scientific literature.
And one of the things you asked about in the survey you did for this report is how many people know about some of the particular theories. What are some of the best known ones out there that we've heard of?
So the one about the FDA colluding with the pharmaceutical companies, that's one which is very widely known in the American public. The autism question, another one which is very widely known is this idea that fluoridization is used as a type of control of political opposition rather than as a way to reduce the incidence of dental caries. It really struck us because my co-author and I, Professor Eric Oliver, we normally research political conspiracies. And often when we ask people about whether they've heard of some of the more unlikely, implausible sounding political conspiracies, we get much lower incidences of people having previously heard of those, and we were struck by how widely known some of these accounts are.
Well, why would that be? I guess maybe the political conspiracy, it might upset us, but it might not spread because it doesn't have that personal impact, whereas a health thing, well, gosh, if that's true, that could be a big problem. Is that why it might spread more, do you think?
So that part of it, I think. In politics, we have sometimes the things that we observe going on in the press and is reported on. Like, we can make sense of politics using the historical record, and sometimes politics makes sense that way. But when we're dealing with something as uncertain, as often invisible as the things which make us healthy and sick, I think people are drawn to accounts which give that order. Like, people generally, this is apparent in the psychological literature, when they're aware of some things being from uncertain or seemingly random sources, like why some people get sick, why others don't get sick, why some people respond to pharmaceuticals, others don't. We don't like those sort of uncertain, deeply, at their heart, random accounts. And so we've traditionally sought to give order to that, even if it's an illogical, uncertain type of story. And that's sometimes why we see the proliferation of conspiracy theories accounting for medical phenomena.
So you're saying we want medical science to give us a clear-cut answer. Blank causes blank. If you don't blank, you won't get the disease. The reality is we're talking statistics a lot of the time, so people look for something more straightforward, even if it doesn't seem plausible.
We're not drawn to these deeply contingent and conditional answers, and the fact that medical science often has to tell us this is our best guess, a new study or new data might suggest some other relationship. People are unsatisfied with that. And whereas physicians and epidemiologists only make those claims because that's all that the data allow them to make, often people read malicious intent, malign intent in making those sorts of arguments. And so it's a simpler world in which people actively, the physicians are actively conspiring against this rather than they're often sometimes simply powerless against certain maledictions. And so that's not an attractive worldview that people adopt.
there are people listening right now, I'm sure, who are thinking, wait, conspiracy theory? Whether we're talking about fluoridation of water or the vaccine autism concept, they're thinking that's not a conspiracy theory. I think that's true, or I think the jury's out on it. Have you gotten some angry responses since this paper came out?
Really? So that's really all we've received from the audience. It struck my co-author and I, when we've spoken about political conspiracies, it hasn't elicited nearly so much response on the basis of the face validity of the claims. And so, I mean, like, I guess the best answer we have is that we're not medical professionals. We're making no claim about the inherent truth or inaccuracy of these accounts. We are really only interested in those things which predict the rise and decline of these particular theories and the consequence that these theories adoption have on the type of health behaviors people engage in. So if it's your conviction that all these accounts are true, like none of our research can speak to the validity or falseness of those claims. Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to take it to the next point you just mentioned there, the consequences of people having these beliefs and how it might affect their health behaviors. What in your survey and your research have you found?
So it's hard to tease apart cause and effect. It's the sort of thing where we wouldn't be able to do an experiment under medical ethics rules. We couldn't randomly induce in some people some set of beliefs about medical conspiracies and then observe the consequential behavior. So instead, we're left with statistics to use controls to try to determine the effect of just these attitudes on medical behaviors, holding all of our things constant. And when we do those sorts of studies, a very interesting pattern emerges wherein the types of people who adopt and evince support for these conspiracies are much less likely to engage in the preventative medical practices that we know are very important to maintaining health. So they're less likely to see a doctor for a checkup. They're less likely to visit a dentist. They're less likely to wear sunscreen. They're more likely to think that herbal remedies are a good source of a good way to treat illness. And these results are apparent even after we've removed the separate effects of people's education, their race, their income, and those sorts of things. And so it does appear as if these behaviors do have meaningful, tangible consequences on health outcomes.
Do you think there are any lessons here about how to communicate with the public about health issues, either broad stroke public health or a doctor in their office?
I think the relationship with, like, the consequence of this study is this private relationship between a doctor and her patient is very meaningful, because almost the worst thing to do would be to engage some massive government or pharmaceutical apparatus to attempt to dispel these ideas, because
they're in only
among that coterie of people for whom these attitudes are fundamental to their worldview. Like, such a program would appear like consistent with his claims, but for those like fortunate occasions where folks who adopt these attitudes are suspicious of physicians, when they are, with a physician, I think this is a useful tool for a diagnostic capacity of, is this patient likely to participate and abide by the prescribed pharmaceuticals, whatever that the prescribed course of treatment that I'm suggesting. I think this, like, if it's apparent that a patient has some of these worldviews, some of these attitudes, I think it's a fairly good indication that the doctor should pay a special attention to the patient's subsequent behavior, or behavior outside the surgery, because, like, it's very likely that these are the people for whom their suspicion will reduce the extent to which they abide by the undertakings they make to the physician.
Tom, before I let you go, I want to ask why you and your colleague are interested in conspiracy theories in general, political, medical, or otherwise.
It's part of a broader project. There's been evidence for the last 20 to 30 years coming out of universities like Wisconsin and Michigan and Chicago that the ways in which people make political decisions doesn't really reflect a dispassionate weighing of their material circumstance. People use these sort of narratives as a way to sort of make homespun conceptions of politics and the world and then deduce political and other attitudes from these narratives. And so this is part of a broader project that Professor Oliver and I are pursuing to sort of come to grips with the ways that people make political decisions and people make political determinations, and interestingly enough, it also impacts really meaningful things. So you might think that, like, if a person adopts a political attitude, a political conspiracy, and that has consequences, that political attitudes, like, who cares really, you know? But when it's even impacting things like how frequently these people visit the dentist or whether they're willing to wear sunscreen, it seems that there's something much more fundamental at work here, and it's just interesting to understand that way of decision making.
Tom, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That was Thomas Wood, co-author of a new study on medical conspiracy theories.